Okay, I have some of the assignments that are due today on 1 Samuel 17. If you have that, you can set it up here. We have beyond today, 2 more weeks of class, 2 more assignments in Bullock. So we go back to Bullock after a vacation from that for a time. Last week, we were looking at the book of Joshua. We were down through 3b. No, 3c. C is the conquest of Canaan, Joshua 5 to 12. And we had looked at the end of the hour that the attack on Ai, and Israel's defeat, and the determination that the reason for that defeat was because Achan had taken up the devoted bank, and when Achan was found and judged, then in chapter 8, Israel went up to Ai again and was victorious rather than defeated. That led at the end of the hour to fairly lengthy discussion of the archaeological findings relating to the site that is known as Ai in the biblical record, and the problem of site identification. And traditional identification of Ai was a mountain called Etel. Traditional identification of Bethel was a mountain called Achim, and Livingston, as well as some others, have argued that the archaeological problem related to Bethel is a problem really of site identification. I've looked for another site, either Kirbet Nisa or Kirbet El Makatir, the latter one being the one that seems to have the most promise presently. That also involves a re-identification of the site of Bethel, because Bethel and I were close together, probably then moving Bethel to Beer. I don't want to get back into the details of that discussion, but that's where we ended last week. So let's go on to 3 under C, which is renewal of the covenant at Shechem. Question.
Wait, would that Bethel be the same Bethel?
Yes. Renewal of the covenant at Shechem, Joshua 8:30 to 35. After that victory at Ai, we read that Joshua, this is verse 30 of chapter 8, built on Mount Ebal an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, and he built it according to what is written in the book of the law of Moses. In other words, he followed the altar law, which is found in the Book of the Covenant in Exodus, making it of uncut stones on which no iron tool had been used. In other words, he didn't build it like the Canaanite altars. But then verse 32, Joshua copied on stones the law of Moses, which he had written. And All Israel, aliens and citizens alike, with their elders, officials and judges, were standing on both sides of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, facing those who carried it, the priests who were the Levites. Half of the people stood in front of Mount Gerizim, half in front of Mount Ebal. And then you read in verse 34, Joshua read all the words of the law, the blessings and the curses, just as it is written in the book of the law. He read to the whole assembly, including women, children, and aliens who lived among them. What Joshua is doing there is following the instructions that Moses had given on the plains of Moab, and you find those instructions repeated in the book of Deuteronomy 2 times in 11, 26 to 30, where Moses says, Go down to verse 29 of that section. When the Lord your God has brought you into the land you are entering to possess, you are to proclaim on Mount Gerizim the blessings and all the curses. And then in chapter 27 of Deuteronomy, the first 8 verses, Moses says in verse 2, when you cross the Jordan, set up large stones, coat them with plaster, write on them all the words of this law. And then verse 4, set up these stones on Mount Ebal. And verse 5, build there an altar to the Lord your God. So you see, Joshua now is carrying out those instructions. Immediately after taking Jericho and Ai, they go to Ebal and Gerizim and do what Moses had commanded. So it seems to me that after those initial victories, Israel is recognizing the conditions under which they were to possess the land. Obedience to the stipulations of the covenant, and blessing if they obeyed, cursing if they disobeyed. Right at the beginning of occupation of the land, they are reminded of those things. Let's go on to 4, which is the southern campaign in chapters 9 and 10. You read in chapter 9, first few verses, that the Israelites were deceived into making a treaty with some inhabitants of the land, led by the inhabitants of a city called Gibeon. You read that in verse 3, the people of Gibeon, when they heard what Joshua had done to Jericho, they resorted to a ruse. And they sent a delegation with worn-out sacks, old wineskins, worn and patched sandals, and old clothes, moldy and dried bread. And they go to Israel's camp at Gilgal, which was their base camp. And they say, at the end of verse 6, we have come from a distant country. Make a treaty with us. And the Israelites are a bit skeptical. They say, perhaps you live near us. How can we make a treaty with you? And they say in verse 9, we have come from a very distant country. And if you go down to verse 11, the last sentence, they say, we are your servants. Make a treaty with us. This bread of ours was warm when we packed it, but now see how dry and moldy it is. In verse 14, you read, the men of Israel sampled their provisions, but did not inquire of the Lord. And verse 15 tells us Joshua, in the NIV, made a treaty of peace with them to let them live. And the leaders of the assembly ratified it by oath. Now, the language here is the language of the treaty formulas. You notice if you go back there to verse 7, these Gibeonites say, make a treaty with us. That's, if you look in the Hebrew, it's karak parim, it's the cut of covenant. And you notice in verse 8, they say, we are your servants. We are, that's in essence saying, we are your vassal. And then when you get down there in verse 15, and it says in the NIV, Joshua made a treaty of peace with them. That's a somewhat of a paraphrase, because if you look at the Hebrew, it says Joshua cut a covenant with them, parak parit. And then it says that he made peace with them. He cut a covenant and made peace with them, which the NIV has translated then as a covenant of peace. But a shalom peace was what was to exist between treaty partners. They were to be at peace with one another. And then the ratification by oath, that was customary in the establishment of treaties or covenants. We swore by oath, you know, we talked about that with the biblical covenant, that Israel took the oath in the Sinai covenant, the whole covenant. God took the oath in the promissory covenant for Abraham. But then verse 16 tells us 3 days after they made the treaty with the Gibeonites, the Israelites heard they were neighbors living among them. They're Canaanites who had fooled Israel into ratifying this treaty in the name of Yahweh. They swore to them. And you notice at the end of, or in verse 18, the first part, the Israelites did not attack them because the leaders of the assembly had sworn an oath to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. They were not going to break that oath that they had taken in the name of the Lord. And it was not just Gibeon, because you read in verse 17 that Gibeon, Kephira, Beeroth, and Kirjath-Jearim were all involved. Gibeon was the major city. They certainly had been the more important of those cities. But that was the situation. So, in verse 21, you read what Israel did there then. They said, let them live, but let them be woodcutters and water carriers for the entire community. So they kept their promise. They did not attack the Gibeonites. So, when the other inhabitants of Canaan, other Canaanite cities, learned about this arrangement, this treaty between the Gibeonites and the Israelites, they decide to go and attack Gibeon. And that's chapter 10. You read in those first verses of an alliance of five kings. You read, Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had taken Ai, totally destroyed it, and that the people of Gibeon had made a treaty of peace with Israel. And then it says in verse 2, Gibeon was an important city. It was larger than Ai. All its men were good fighters. So, Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, appealed to Hoam, king of Hebron, Piram, king of Jarmuth, Japhia, king of Lachish, Debir, king of Eglon. You have these five kings, and they form a coalition, and they say, come, or the king of Jerusalem, Adonai Zedek, says, come up and help me attack Gibeon, because it has made peace with Joshua and the Israelites. So, those five kings, you read in verse 5, joined their forces. And at the end of 5, it says they moved up with all their troops, took up positions against Gibeon and attacked it. Now, that puts Joshua and the Israelites in a bond, because they have concluded a treaty with the Gibeonites. And the Gibeonites do exactly what we might expect them to do. Verse 6, the Gibeonites sent word to Joshua, do not abandon your servants. We are your servants. We've concluded a treaty of peace with you. Undoubtedly, there was a protection clause in the treaty. That was typical of treaty. Protection clause in the Sinai Treaty of Yahweh with Israel, that he would fight their battle. He would defeat their enemy. So they call to Joshua, do not abandon your servants. Come up to us quickly. Save us. Help us, because all the Amorite kings from the hill country have joined forces against us. And so Joshua does what undoubtedly was required by the treaty agreement. He marched up from Gilgal with his army, including the best fighting men. And the Lord says, don't be afraid of them. I've given them into your hand. Not one of them will be able to withstand you. Now, I want to read the following verses from 9 through 13 or 14, because this is probably, in the aftermath of this, one of the more often discussed miracles in the Old Testament. Joshua, you read in verse 9, marched all night. Notice that all night. We're going to come back to that. From Gilgal, took them by surprise. The Lord threw them into confusion before Israel, who defeated them in a great victory at Gibeon. Israel pursued them along the road going up to Bethhoron, cut them down all the way to Azekah and Makeda. As they fled before Israel on the road from Bethhoron to Azekah, there was a storm. The Lord hurled large hailstones down from the sky. More of them died from the hailstones than were killed by the swords of Israel. On the day the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, O son, this is the miracle that has attracted so much discussion and attention. O sun, stand still over Gibeon, O moon over the valley of Ajalon. So the sun stood still, the moon stopped, till the nation avenged itself on its enemies. It is written in the book of Jasher, the sun stopped in the middle of the sky, delayed going down about a full day. There's never been a day like it, before or since. A day when the Lord listened to a man, surely the Lord was fighting for Israel. Here is that divine warrior. Then Joshua returned with all Israel to camp of Gilgal. Now, with respect to that description of the sun standing still, that's attracted a lot of discussion. I think there are three basic approaches that have been taken as far as interpretation of what's going on here is concerned. And let me go through them quickly with you. A first interpretation would be that of most mainstream biblical scholars that we'll find in a large number of commentaries. And that view is, this is a passage that is to be taken literally, but not something that is historically reliable. It must be legend, because things like that don't happen. That's largely, I think, a rationalistic kind of view that is governed by a worldview that does not permit divine interventions of this sort into the natural order of things. So they would understand the description here literally, but say that's just like non-historic. A second approach would be a poetical or non-literal interpretation of the passage. And I would include with that as well what might be called a Heil's Geschichtliche view, salvation history view. Poetic or Heil's Geschichtliche Heil being salvation Geschichtliche historical. If it's taken as poetical, which some do, then it is understood to be a statement, that is, the statements in verses 12 and 13. Statements much like the expressions you find elsewhere in the Old Testament of the hills and the mountains skipping, or the trees clapping their hands, or as Judges 5:20, you know, in Judges 5 you have a poetic account of the battle against Sisera, where it says the stars fight against Sisera. there in Judges 5:20. Even a commentator such as Tyler, of the Tyler Daily Commentary Series, which is generally a reliable conservative commentary, sees it as a figurative way of saying that Joshua's prayer to the Lord for help was answered with renewed vigor in his soldiers, who then fought so valiantly that they did a day's work in half a day. And it seemed to them that the day had been lengthened. So you might call that a subjective lengthening. And this is to be read kind of figuratively or poetically. If you look at your citations, page 55, there's a paragraph from Kyle where he says, "It must be borne in mind that it is not stated that God lengthened that day at the request of Joshua almost an entire day, or that he made the sun stand still almost a whole day, but simply that God hearkened to the voice of Joshua. That is, did not permit the sun to go down until Israel had avenged itself upon its enemies. This distinction is not without importance. For a miraculous prolongation of the day would take place not only, notice this, if the sun's course or sun setting was delayed for several hours by the omnipotent power of God and the day extended from 12 to 18 or 20 hours, but also if the day seemed to Joshua and to all Israel to be miraculously prolonged." Why? Because the work accomplished was so great that it would have required almost 2 days to accomplish it without supernatural aid. See, that's a non-literal reading, a subjective lengthening. And then Kyle's comment is, it's not easy to decide between these two views. And skipping down, you notice he says the Israelites didn't have clocks. And during the confusion of the battle, it's hardly likely that Joshua or anyone else engaged in the conflict would watch the shadow of the sun and its changes to discover that the sun had actually stood still. So he says, under such circumstances, it was quite impossible for the Israelites to decide whether it was in reality or only in their own imagination that the day was longer than ours. And then he makes the last statement. To this, there must be added the poetical character of these verses before us. Those two verses, 12 and 13, or at least 12b and 13, are Hebrew poetry, but as far as their literary form is concerned, they're not in prose. You can see the parallelism of the poetic form. So that's a poetical view. I'm linking with that this Heil's Geschichtliche view. This is common in a fair number of mainstream commentaries today, who take these books, historical books, to be more theology than history. And someone such as a German scholar named Sternhagel says, this is a story that is told from out of Israel's religious conviction that God helped his people at the time of the conquest. Israel was convinced that Yahweh was helping them conquer the land, and they expressed that conviction in stories of this sort. So stories such as this and the crossing of the Jordan are important as a witness to Israel's faith, but they're worthless as far as telling us about anything that really happened. Now, that approach, you may recognize, if any of you have had the course Foundation of Biblical History, where I talked about the ideas of Gerhard von Rad,
and his theology of the Old Testament, and his discussion of the character of the historical material of the Pentateuch and of these books. He says that these stories are an expression of Israel's faith, and that they are a creation of that faith. In other words, Israel confessed her faith by speaking of things that God, quote, did. But he says that sort of confessional history has little or nothing to do with history in the sense of what actually happened. Now, if, I think that this is an important issue, and I can't take a lot of time to get into it in detail here, but if this story, as well as other similar stories of divine intervention, miraculous events, whether at the time of the Exodus, crossing the Jordan, this battle, whatever, if they are simply an expression of Israel's faith, it seems to me what you're saying then is that the relationship, I might say the order of the relationship between faith and history is reversed. In other words, from a biblical standpoint, history is foundational to faith. Faith is a response to what God says and does in history. It's not the other way around. Faith does not create the history. Faith is rooted in and nourished in God's acts in history. So I think ultimately Israel's religious conviction of the power of God and his activity in history is really no different than ours. It rests on what God has done by word and deed in history. And if those words and deeds are simply an expression of Israel's faith, or the faith of the early church, if we come to the similar situation with New Testament accounts of divine intervention, then the basis on which Israel's faith, and really ours, the basis on which it is grounded, is destroyed. So I think that to simply reduce this to a Heilsgeschichtliche sort of construct, theological construct, that is an expression of Israel's faith but tells us nothing about whatever actually happened, is a dangerous position to pick. But those are two views. One is kind of rationalistic, legendary kind of explanation for these verses. Second, this poetic or Heilsgeschichtliche view. Third view would be a literal view and a historical reliable view. This is literal, and it's something that happened. But even there, a question arises. And the question, interpretive question, that still is there, is what did Joshua ask for? Did Joshua ask for prolongation of light in order to attack and defeat this coalition of kings? Or did he ask for prolongation of darkness? In other words, did he want more daylight to defeat the enemy, or did he want relief from the heat of the sun to defeat this coalition of forces under the cover of darkness? I think generally, the way this has been read, and it's the most straightforward way to read it, is prolongation of light. It's a longer day. The sun stood still over Gibeon. And if it stood still, it's not moving. When it starts, it's going to be a longer day. If you take that understanding
and ask the question, well, how could something like that happen? There are two explanations for how that could happen that I've come across. One would involve cessation of the rotation of the Earth on its axis and the Moon in its orbit. In other words, it's not that the Sun is going around the Earth. The Earth spinning on its axis gives that appearance. And of course, the Earth spinning on its axis at the same time rotating around the Sun. But it would be a cessation of the rotation of the Earth on its axis, cessation of the Moon in its orbit, so that the Sun stands still and the Moon stays, as it says in the text. Well, could that happen? Well, I think you can't say it couldn't happen. Divine power can certainly cause something like that. But others explain it in a different way and say the miracle involves some sort of a miracle of refraction of light so that it appears that the Sun and the Moon did not move in their normal courses. But they may well have continued to move, but there was a miracle of refraction of light. Astronomers say every day when you watch the sun set, you can really see the sun 4 seconds after it has gone below the horizon due to a refraction of light as it hits the atmosphere and bends those rays of light so that I'm not sure you can decide exactly what the mechanism was, or but it would be a divine divine action that caused it, however this was, a prolongation of life. But there's another view that says no, it wasn't prolongation of light, but prolongation of darkness. In your citations, page 54, there's a lengthy paragraph from H.J. Blair in his commentary on Joshua in the New Bible Commentary Revised Edition. I'm not going to read that paragraph, but I want to run through the basic ideas of Blair's interpretation of these verses. Blair points out that Joshua's prayer was made in the early morning hours. Look at verse 9. After an all-night march from Gilgal, Joshua took them by surprise. So Joshua is moving his forces through the night. And you read in verse 12 that the sun stood still over Gibeon and the moon over the valley of Ajalon. Let me see if this map will come up. If you look at, you can see that Gibeon is here. Valley of Ajalon is over here. And in verse 12, you read, the sun stood still over Gibeon. That's to the east. So the sun is rising. The moon over Ajalon, the moon's to the west. So it's the early morning hours, it seems. Now, with that in mind, let me go back. Blair suggests that when you read in verse 12, sun stands still over Gibeon, and also in verse 13, so the sun stood still. In both of those cases, in 12, sun stands still upon Gibeon, and the sun stood still, the Hebrew verb is dome. And dome has the basic meaning of be silent, cease, or leave off. So you could translate that, sun cease over Gibeon. And in verse 13, so the sun ceased, instead of stood still, ceased to shine. Revolved from shining. In verse 13, where you read the moon stayed underlined, as well as the phrase, so the sun stood still underlined, both those words underlined are amad in Hebrew, which means to stand in its common meaning. However, if you look at all the usages of amad, it sometimes has the sense of cease. Look at 2 Kings 4:6 and Jonah 1:15. 2 Kings 4:6 says, I need to get the background for this. This is one of the wives of a company of prophets, a member of a company of prophets, whose husband had died, and a creditor was coming to take this woman's two boys as slaves. Instead of payment, she calls on Elisha, and she says, I don't have anything, I can't pay this, I have a little oil. Verse 3, Elisha says, go around, ask all your neighbors for empty jars, don't ask for just a few. Then go inside, shut the door behind you and your sons, pour oil into all the jars, as each is filled, put it to one side. She left him, and afterwards shut the door behind her. They brought the jars, she kept pouring. When all the jars were full, she said to her son, bring me another one. But he replied, there's not a jar left. Then you read the phrase, then the oil stopped flowing. Stopped flowing is on that. The oil ceased. That is the same word, amad. Now, it's not the normal meaning of amad, but it seems to have that sense of the cease in 2 Kings 4:6. In Jonah 1:15, that's where Jonah is tossed into the sea. And you read in 1:15, they took Jonah, threw him overboard, and the raging sea grew calm. Is the NIV translation. It's the sea stood. It's a mat. It ceased from its raging. Rukam is the way NIV translates it. So that's a possible way to translate those phrases. But then in verse 13, we also have the phrase, the sun hastened not to go down about a whole day. To go down is underlined. If you look at the Hebrew for to go down, translated to go down, it's la bo. Bo, you recognize, is come, enter. When used with the sun, bo normally means to set or to go down. However, there's the note there at the bottom. Either yatsa or zarah are usually used, the verb used to express the idea of sunrise. However, in Isaiah 61, arise, shine, for your light is come, underline come, that's both. And the glory of the Lord has risen, that's zarah upon you. Bo is parallel to zarah. It's possible to argue that bo can apply to the coming of light and the rising of the sun. About a whole day. The other phrase in verse 13. Sun delayed going down about a whole day. Hebrew is kiyom tamim. Kiyom is day, with the top as or like, and then tamim. Tamim is the idea of what is complete or finished. So you could translate about a whole day. But Blair suggests translating that as when day is done. So you would say then the sun hastened not to rise as when day is done. In other words, it's dark. The sun ceased shining in the midst of the sky, did not hasten to come, so that it was as when day is done. So I think that you can make a reasonable case for saying that what Joshua prayed for was a cessation of light. You put that back into the context, and you read about the all-night march in verse 9, and in verse 11 you read the Lord hurled large hailstones, and more of this coalition force died from hailstones than were killed by the swords of the Israelites. So you would understand Joshua coming up there through the night, then a storm coming, prolonging darkness, killing by hailstones a number of the soldiers, and you have a prolongation of darkness rather than a prolongation of light. It is still a divine intervention that the Lord gives the victory. We read at the end of verse 13, surely the Lord was fighting for Israel. I would say this latter reading, in some respects, I think does more justice to the whole of the context about the night and the storm, as compared to prolongation of light. But on the other hand, it's an unusual way of reading a number of these words. I think it's possible, but it's not the most apparent way to read them. So you can reflect on that. I think no matter what way you read it, the important thing is the Lord intervened to give Israel the victory.
Thank you, Joseph. Just say that similar to what happened in Egypt when the plague, where it was dark all night, or dark for a period of time, and you feel that darkness, but the lightning goes to where you die.
No, there's some parallel there. Yeah. All right. That victory, we're talking here under the heading the Southern Campaign, Joshua 9 and 10. That victory inaugurated what you might call the Southern Campaign. That map's not going to be of much help, but it's on your print-off. Let's see, number. Number 49. Well, that is, yeah, that's 49. Yeah. You read in 10:16 that the five kings fled after that attack by Joshua and the Israelites, and they hid in a cave at Makkedah. And that's on the previous map, which was the 48. I can't pick that out on there either. But in any case, they hid at that cave, and when Joshua heard about it, verse 17, he said, roll large rocks up to the mouth of the cave, put some men there to guard it, but don't stop, pursue your enemies. So they pursued the army and then returned to that cave. And in verse 22, Joshua had the five kings brought out. And then in verse 26, you read Joshua struck and killed the kings, hung them on five trees. It's on slide 51. Oh, the different numbers are different than the ones up here.
I think I
would
see on the left hand side.
Oh, yeah, I agree. That's
one we can't see. Yeah. But it's 51 on your handout instead of 49. It's down in that bottom left corner of there, apparently. So you read in 26, Joshua struck and killed the kings, hung them on five trees. Some said they were taken down, and at the mouth of the cave they placed large rocks, which are there to this day. There's another, I think, memorial or monument. Five rocks, they're there to this day, a reminder of the Lord giving victory over these five kings. But from there, you read in verses 29 through the end of the chapter of the cities that Joshua took in the southern part of the land of Canaan. You notice in verse 32, the Lord handed Lachish over to Israel. Joshua took it. In verse 33, meanwhile, Horam, king of Gezer, had come up to help Lachish, but Joshua defeated him and his army. Verse 34, they moved to Eglon, attacked it, and they destroyed everyone in it just as they had done to Lachish. Verse 36, they went from Eglon to Hebron, attacked it, took the city. Verse 38, they attacked Debir, took the city. Its king, its villages, put them to the sword. They did to Debir and its king as they had done to Libna and its king and so forth. So, in that southern area of Canaan, they took city after city after city. And you get a summary in verse 40 and following. Joshua subdued the whole region. He totally destroyed all who believed, just who breathed, just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. And then in verse 41, there's a description, I think, of the boundaries of the territory that Joshua took in the south. It says, Joshua subdued them from Kadesh Barnea to Gaza and from the whole region of Goshen to Gibeon. So you get four towns mentioned. I think Kadesh Barnea is the southern boundary. Kadesh Barnea was about 80 kilometers south of Beersheba. Now later, Dan to Beersheba were the north to the south, speaking of the land of Israel. Kadesh Barnea is about 80 kilometers, that's about 50 miles further south than Kadesh Barnea. Gaza would be the west. Gaza's on the coast, and that southern area where it still is today, where the Philistines were in the Old Testament period. So you have south, you have the west, Gaza, Goshen. You don't want to be confused. That's not the Goshen in Egypt. It's a Goshen in the hill country of Judah. Later in the book of Joshua, where the tribal borders are described, if you look in 11:16 and 15:51 of Joshua, 11:15 is later in this chapter, but look at 15:51. In the hill country, a number of towns, Goshen, Holon, Nero, and that's under the inheritance of the tribe of Judah. That's verse 20, is the inheritance of the tribe of Judah. It includes that Goshen. So that most think that was in the hill country of Judah, south of Jerusalem, probably in the eastern Negev, so it's probably an eastern point. And then the northern point would be Gibeon at verse 30. So those four cities, you kind of get a circle of the territory that was taken by Joshua in that southern campaign. Question, comment? Let's go on to 5, which is the northern campaign. Joshua 11, 1 to 20.
You read in chapter 11 of another coalition of forces. You read that when Jabin, king of Hazor, which was a large northern city, heard of this, heard what Joshua had been able to accomplish in the south, he sent word to Jobab, the king of Madon, to the kings of Shimron and Akshba, and to the northern kings who were in the mountains of the Arabah south of Kinnereth, Sea of Galilee area, in the western foothills, and Naphoth Dor on the west, to the Canaanites in the east, and west of the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites, the hill country, to the Hivites below Hermon, in the region of Mizpah. So you have all these people in the north. They came out with all their troops, a large number of horses and chariots, a huge army as numerous as the sand on the seashore. And they gathered to camp at a place called the Waters of Merom to fight against Israel. So here in the north, another strong coalition of forces. What's the Lord say to Joshua? Notice verse 6. Do not be afraid of them, even though it's an army as numerous as the sand on the seashore. Because by this time tomorrow, I will hand all of them over to Israel, slain. Then you get this interesting additional statement. You were to hamstring their horses and burn their chariots. Now, why is that good? You know, often when you have a battle, the victor takes the weapons of the defeated enemy and begins to use them himself. But the Lord says to Joshua, don't take their horses and try to use them yourself. Hamstring. Make them useless. And burn their chariots. I think what's going on here is a principle that you find elsewhere in the Old Testament. If you look at Psalm 20, verse 7. Read there. Some trust in chariots and some in horses. But we trust in the name of the Lord our God. They are brought to their knees and fall. But we rise up and stand firm. It's interesting that when you get to the time of David in 2 Samuel 8, where David lists his conquests, you find in 2 Samuel 8:4, David captured 1,000 of his chariots, that is, chariots of Hadad-Ezer, son of Reuel, king of Zobah. He captured 1,000 of his chariots and 7,000 charioteers and 20,000 foot soldiers. And then notice the next statement. He hamstrung all but 100 of the chariot horses. So he did basically the same thing Joshua did, except he kept 100 of them. When you get to 2 Samuel 15:1, here is Absalom, who attempts to overthrow David. What's Absalom do? Absalom provided himself with a chariot and horses and with 50 men to run ahead of him. Seems like a different idea of the role of the king. 1 Kings 4:26, you get to the time of Solomon. What's Solomon do with chariots and horses? Solomon had 4,000 stalls for chariot horses, 12,000 horses. So you see the progression from the time of Joshua, hamstring all the horses. And then as kingship gets established, David has 100, Solomon has
4,000 horses. And then you get into the book of Isaiah. Isaiah says in Isaiah 2:7, speaking of Israel, their land is full of silver and gold. There's no end to their treasuries. Their land is full of horses. There's no end to their chariots. The land is full of idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their fingers have made. So man will be brought low, mankind humbled. Do not forgive them. Judgment will come. Verse 12, the Lord Almighty has a day in store for all the proud and lofty, for all of his exalted. In verse 17, the arrogance of man will be brought low, the pride of man humbled. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. And Isaiah 31:1, the Lord says, woe to those who go down to Egypt for help, who rely on horses, who trust in the multitude of their chariots and in the great strength of their horsemen, but do not look to the Holy One of Israel or seek help from the Lord. There's the issue. And that's raised here right as Israel begins to take the land of Canaan. But to go further in this chapter, was there a question here?
In chapter 4, verse 14, is that the expression of how Egypt is?
A song? Yeah, partly. That. I don't think there was anything wrong with the riches per se, but I think that Solomon began to trust more in his military machine, you might say, his weapons, the size of his forces, than to trust in the Lord. And eventually his heart was turned, as you read in 1 Kings 11. He multiplied wives. Look at 1 Kings 11. Where it says, verse 4, as Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart first over, his heart after other gods. His heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father was. And he did evil in the eyes of the Lord, did not follow the Lord completely. And verse 9, the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord. And you can read down further on that. But it seems to me there's nothing wrong with riches in themselves, and the Lord, I think, blessed Solomon with riches. But I think the issue is, where was Solomon looking for security? Was he attempting to find security by being obedient to the word of the Lord, the demands of the covenant, or was he seeking to find security in his military money? Yeah.
Could you tell me why you don't really talk about that? But what you should give is not have to. One of the main things is not allowed to have a lot of lives, not allowed to have a lot of horses.
Exactly. First, Deuteronomy 17, not multiply wives, not multiply horses. Solomon did both. Okay. But in, the Lord gave the victory. You read that in verse 8. They defeated them, pursued them, and then you read in 9b, Joshua did what the Lord said. He hamstrung their horses, burned their chariots. He didn't keep any of them. And then it reads that he took all that territory in the north. So you read a summary again in verse 16. Joshua took this entire land, the hill country, all the Negev, the whole region of Goshen. That's Goshen again, is that city in the highlands of Judah. The western foothills, the Araba, Goshen being in the east, and the mountains of Israel with their foothills. He captured all their kings, except for those living in Gibeon
Not one city made a treaty of peace with the Israelites. And you read verse 20, for it was the Lord himself who hardened their hearts to wage war against Israel so that he might destroy them totally, exterminating them without mercy as the Lord had commanded Moses. And then in 23, so Joshua took the entire land, just as the Lord had directed Moses, and he gave it as an inheritance to Israel according to their tribal divisions. I quote along the commentary of Joshua by David Howard in the New American Commentary series. He makes some interesting statements in commenting on the theology of Joshua 6 to 12, the passage we've just been looking at. I just want to read a paragraph. It's not in your citations, but this is on page 287 of David Howard's commentary on Joshua, New American Commentary series. He makes this comment. Israel could not take the land without God's presence among them and going before them. He repeatedly reminded Joshua and the people that he was with them and that they should not fear, for he would fight for them. In every military encounter, God provided the victory for his people. In the major encounters at Jericho, Ai, and Gibeon, and the waters of Merom, the text calls attention to the fact that God fought for Israel, that he gave the enemies into Israel's hand. In the minor encounters in chapter 10, the same is stated for most of the cities conquered. That's that southern campaign. Not once did the Israelites win a victory due to their superior military force. In most cases, it was as if the Israelites merely had to stand back and observe God at work on their behalf. So he goes on to say further along, God and God alone was the victor in these battles against his enemies. Remember, we, very beginning of our discussion of Joshua, emphasized that the theme was, one of the themes that repeatedly appears through the book is that the Lord was given the land of Canaan to his people. So you get that summary of the conquest at the end of 11. I read verse 23, Joshua took the entire land, just as the Lord had directed Moses. But then you turn over after chapter 12, where you get a list of all the cities and kings that Joshua took. You turn over to chapter 13 in the first verse, and you read, when Joshua was old and well advanced in years, the Lord said to him, you are very old. There are still very large areas of land to be taken over. This is the land that remains, and you have a list of places. How do you put 13:1? There are still very large areas to be taken over, together with 11:23. Joshua took the entire land, just as the Lord had directed. Some people see a flat-out contradiction from 11:23 and 13:1. I don't think that's the way it's to be read. Seems to me what happened in that southern campaign and that northern campaign is that Joshua first went south and took a number of the major cities and broke the Canaanite resistance. Then he did the same thing in the north, defeated that coalition of kings, broke the will to resist in the north. But Israel was yet, as until after the tribal possessions have been described and each tribe went in and settled to occupy the territory given to them to complete the conquest. And you get in Judges chapter 1, you find that each tribe was to go into their territory and to complete the conquest. And some of them, in fact most of them, didn't do that. And that's where you get the aftermath described in the book of Judges. I think if you look at the recent situation of the war with Iraq, you know, you had that initial swift campaign that went up from the south all the way up to Baghdad and
and defeated the Iraqi army. There's one of these split campaigns, but in the aftermath, you know, major, what they call it, major combat operations are over now, but this thing of then implementing in all the little towns and villages the conquest is something that's still ongoing. And it seems to me there's probably a similar situation that's in Uyghur. D on your outline is the division of the land, chapters 13 to 22. I'm not just going to go through 13 to 22. This is kind of material you might have some difficulty reading and keeping interest, because for the most part, it's a list of cities or towns. And those towns are the perimeters of each of the tribal territories. Now, this section of Joshua is of enormous interest to people who are interested in historical geography. Try to locate these sites and draw the borders according to all these lists of places. Of course, you get into site identification. And then that means if you compare atlases, you're going to see the boundaries a little bit different in some than others, which the question of site identification. But that's pretty much what you have in chapters 13 to 22. I do want to call your attention to one other thing that is mentioned in this section that is of great importance, and that is the location of the tabernacle. You read in 18:1. In the middle of this section, the whole assembly of Israelites gathered at Shiloh and set up the tent of meeting there. The country was brought under their control, but there were still seven Israelite tribes who had not yet received their inheritance. So the tabernacle was to be located at Shiloh, and it remained at Shiloh through the period of the judges, into the time of Samuel. And you remember then the Philistines attacked and captured the ark and destroyed Shiloh. So initially, the ark was placed at Shiloh. And then in chapter 22, you have a chapter where the people from Transjordan, Reuben, Gad, half tribe of Manasseh, who had accompanied Israel on the conquest, go back across Transjordan to settle in that territory. So just those two comments about section on the division of the land, Joshua 13 to 22. That brings us to Eve, Joshua's last days. Chapters 23 and 24. As you begin chapter 23, you read, after a long time had passed, and the Lord had given Israel rest from all their enemies around them, Joshua by then, old and well advanced in years, summoned all Israel, their elders, leaders, judges, and officials, and said to them, I am old and well advanced in years. You've seen all that the Lord has done. And what he goes on to do is exhort Israel to remain faithful to the Lord, to love God with all their heart, mind, and soul, and to obey his commandments. Because if they do not obey, they can be assured that the Lord will judge them. You notice what he says in verse 12. If you turn away from the Lord and ally yourselves with the survivors of these nations that remain among you, if you intermarry with them and associate with them, then you may be sure the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. Instead, they will become snares and traps for you, whips on your backs, thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land. And then he says in 14, I'm about to let go the way of all the earth. In other words, he's about to die. And he says, you know
Not one of all the good promises the Lord gave you has failed. Every promise has been fulfilled. Not one has failed. But, and here's the other side, just as every good promise of the Lord has come true, so the Lord will bring on you all the evil he has threatened until he has destroyed you from this good land he has given you. If what? If you violate the covenant of the Lord your God, the covenant is at the heart of the relationship between God and his people. You violate the covenant which he commanded you and go and serve other gods, bow down to them, the Lord's anger will burn against you, you will quickly perish from the good land he has given you. So those are Joshua's words of exhortation to the Israelites as he is old and about ready to die. Chapter 24 is very similar. It's difficult to know if 23 and 24 are speaking of the same assembly or 24 is a similar assembly. You notice 24 begins with a place designation. Joshua assembled all the tribes of Israel at Shechem. So we know 24 took place at Shechem. Perhaps 23 at the same place. But when you come to chapter 24 and read through it, I think what you'll find is the elements of the covenant form reappear. We talked about the covenant form modeled after the Hittite treaty form. You have a preamble in 2a. This is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. Preamble identifies the senior partner to the treaty. You have a historical prologue equivalent in 2b to 13. Notice the summary of previous beneficent acts. This is what the Lord God of Israel says. Long ago, your forefathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham, and Nahor, lived beyond the river, worshiped other gods. But I took your father Abraham from the land beyond the river, led him through Canaan, gave him many descendants. I gave him Isaac. To Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau, his son, the hill country of Seir, to Esau. But Jacob and his sons went down to Egypt. Then I sent Moses and Aaron. I afflicted the Egyptians by what I did there and brought you out. When I brought your fathers out of Egypt, you came to the sea, and the Egyptians pursued them with chariots and horsemen as far as the Red Sea. But they cried to the Lord for help. He put darkness between you and the Egyptians. He brought the sea over them, covered them. You saw with your own eyes what I did to the Egyptians. Then you lived in the desert for a long time, wilderness period. I brought you to the land of the Amorites, who lived east of the Jordan. They fought against you, but I gave them into your hands. I destroyed them. You took possession of their land when Balaam, son of Zippor, the king of Moab, prepared to fight against Israel. He sent for Balaam, son of Beor, to put a curse on you, but I would not listen to Balaam. So he blessed you again and again, and I delivered you out of his hand. Then you crossed the Jordan, came to Jericho. Cities of Jericho fought against you, as did the Amorites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hittites, Girgashites, Hivites, Jebusites. But I gave them into your hands. I sent the hornet ahead of you, which drove them out before you, also the two Amorite kings. You did not do it with your own sword and bow. There's that emphasis again. So I gave you a land on which you did not toil, cities you did not build, and you lived in them and eat from vineyards and olive groves you did not plant. That's a classic historical prologue, a listing of previous relationship and of the beneficent acts of the great king toward his vassal. Stipulations 14, 15, and 25. And you have both basic and detailed. 14. There's the basic stipulation, that fundamental obligation of loyalty and devotion to the great king. Now fear the Lord, serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt. Serve Yahweh. And then 15. Let me go on to 25. That's the detailed stipulation. That day Joshua made a covenant for the people. And there are Shechem who grew up around decrees and laws. And oath, 16:21 and 24. People answered, 16, far be it from us to forsake the Lord to serve other gods. 21, people said to Joshua, no, we will serve the Lord. 24, people said to Joshua, we will serve the Lord our God, obey him. Witnesses, 22 and 27. Joshua said, you are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen to serve the Lord. Yes, we are witnesses, they replied. And 27, she said to the people, this stone will be a witness against us. It is heard, all the words the Lord has said to us. It will be a witness against you if you are untrue to your God. So you have those basic elements. Oh, there's one more covenant document, 26. Joshua recorded these things in the book of the law of God. He took a large stone, set it up there under the oak near the holy place of the Lord. So you have those basic elements. It's not in a rigid, really stereotype kind of way, but the fundamental ideas of that Hittite cuneiform reflected in the Sinai covenant reappear here in this ceremony held at Shechem at the point in time of transition from the leadership of Joshua to a new era. Remember, you had covenant renewal in the plains of Moab, book of Deuteronomy, transition from Moses' leadership to Joshua's. Now we've come to the end of Joshua's life, and we're going to transition from Joshua being the appointed leader over God's people to a time when Israel settles in the land and has the obligation to live as God's people, really without a national leader. God was their king. Their obligation was to follow the stipulations of the covenant. This was to be a theocracy. Yahweh was the king. And of course, when we get into the book of Judges, we find Israel didn't do that, and things fell apart. Any questions, comments? I gave you that handout at the beginning of the hour on, well, actually there were two. Let's look first at the article, The Theology of Joshua. This is an article I wrote for New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis. It's a 6-volume work. Most of it is word studies, but the volume 4 has a lot of essays. Theology of each book of the Old Testament and some additional essays. So I'd like you to read this article. I may take a question or two out of this article on the final exam. But I want to highlight just a couple things in the article. If you go over to page, bottom of page 813, previous to that, I've been talking about structure of the book of Joshua, but bottom of page 13 and over on page 14, I think you can get an idea of the structure of the book. This is borrowed from a man named Korifar, who wrote a dissertation on the structure of the book of Joshua. It's listed in the bibliography. But you notice the way he outlines the structure, and I think it fits the content. In 1:1 to 5:12, he gives that the title cross. And of course, in Hebrew, that's Avar, Ein Bet Bridge. Cross of all. And he speaks of divine initiatives and closes it as far as content and the structure of the book. So the first divine initiative is cross the Jordan, we say in 1:1-9. The first closing is circumcision, the Passover at Gilgal. We looked at that. So that first section, divine initiative and the closing, 1:1-5:12 is crossed. Top of page 8:14. Second section, 5:13-12:24, is take. Latak. And that is the conquest. God's second initiative, capture Jericho. And 11:16-12:24 is the second closing, review of the victories of the conquest. The third section, 13-21, is divide. The Hebrew there is halak. Now, you notice you go from latak to halak. It's the same letters, just in an inverted order. So you have avar, cross, you have take, latak, you have divide, halak. And God's third initiative, divide Canaan, third closing, conclusion of the vision of Canaan, inheritance of Joshua. God's fourth initiative, designate cities of refuge, fourth closing. And then the fourth section is serve. That's how bad. And you see that kind of parallels the cross. That's how bar, and here's how bad. They look alike. The only difference is a dollop and a rake. Now, a dollop has a little difference from a rake, but it's pretty much the same word. Both pretty much the same word. So I think that gives you a pretty good schematic for what's going on in the book. You cross, you take, you divide, and you serve the Lord. Serve the Lord is those last chapters we just looked at. So Korovar argues that the structurally revealed theological purpose of the entire book of Joshua is found in the third main section. Cross plus take equals divide. The third section is the description of those tribal boundaries. Within that section, the third section, that's the divide section, he finds a concentric chiastic structure, which you see there outlined. Chiasms are an interesting study. Often you wonder how much is brought through the text, how much is inherently in the text, and we start looking at various chiastic structures done by different people, and very often there's disagreement. It depends on, number one, how you define the boundaries of units. It can get debatable in many cases. But in any case, Korovar sees in that third section this chiastic structure. You notice what's at the heart of E, 18:1-10. 10 of meeting taking the Shiloh of the apportionment of the ground. And my comment there, at the center of this structure is the erection of the tent of meeting at Shiloh. Korovar sees this as a fulfillment of the significant Pentateuchal promise, I will put my dwelling place among you, and I will not abhor you, I will walk among you and be your God, you will be my people. This was the last promise in the list of blessings given by Moses in Leviticus 26. And now Israel comes into the land, and the heart of that section on description of the tribal possessions, you have the location of the tabernacle where God comes to dwell in the midst of his people. So those comments on structure. Top of the next page, 8:15, is primary theological themes. And I think when you look at what Korovar has done in other materials and the content of the book, you can say the primary themes are divine initiative and divine presence. The Lord is the one giving the orders. He's taking the initiative. He leads Israel in his conquest. And he is in their midst. They're not divine initiative and divine presence. Subordinate themes. Halfway down the page. A, the divine warrior theme. It's quite prominent in Joshua. B, something we've talked about over in the next page, land as a gift or an inheritance. Last paragraph on page 816, to say that the land was a gift or an inheritance, and to say that Yahweh was the divine warrior who would fight for Israel in her battles of conquest, do not mean that Israel had no responsibility in this conflict. Israel was commanded, quote, to take possession of the land that Yahweh was giving. Human effort is not excluded by divine initiative, but rather it is used by Yahweh to accomplish his purposes when it is exerted in conformity with divine directives. This explains some aspects of the conquest that have often troubled readers of the book of Joshua. And here I want to make some comments on this idea of Kerem that has been something that has troubled, I think, a lot of readers of the book of Joshua. When Israel was commanded to take possession of the land of Canaan, they were also commanded to exterminate its inhabitants. That's Kerem. Various references. The practice of Kerem, giving over things or persons irrevocably to Yahweh, often by totally destroying them, has been viewed by some as sub-Christian. That's the word John Bright uses. The implication of this assessment is that Israel's use of Kerem is dubious in light of further biblical revelation, especially the New Testament. For some, it is even meant that the God concept of the Old Testament is inferior to the God concept of the New Testament. It should be noted, however, and I think this is enormously important when we look at this question, that Genesis 15:16 suggests that when the time of the conquest arrived, Israel would be God's instrument of divine judgment on the Canaanites for their sin. In Genesis 15:16, that is a description of the Lord's promise to Abraham that he was going to give to his descendants the land of Canaan, but they would first go into Egypt for 400 years and come out, because in Genesis 15:16 it says the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. When the iniquity of the Amorites was full, God was going to bring judgment on those Amorites. The instrument of God's judgment on the Amorites or Canaanites was Israel at the time of the conquest. The Canaanites had so defiled the land by their wicked practices that the land would, quote, vomit out its inhabitants, Leviticus 18. So Israel's destruction of the Canaanites is not an example of sub-Christian aggression against the innocent inhabitants of Canaan, but is rather to be seen as the administration of divine judgment on a wicked people for their sin. Israel is the instrument of that divine judgment. It is the divine initiative in the conquest that lifts Kerem out of the realm of all other aggressive wars of national self-interest. That's not what this was. And it sets it in the unique position of demonstrating in advance the ultimate fate of all people who reject the God who is Lord of all the earth. This is what distinguishes Israel's destruction of the Canaanites from all other so-called holy wars. Now, the next paragraph says something about holy war. You know, that term is coming back into prominence today. Jihad is holy war. I mean, it's all around us in the news. Israel was not doing holy war. Holy war is not a biblical term. If you notice halfway through that paragraph, I make the comment, it should be noted that the term holy war is nowhere used in the Old Testament to describe the conquest. A more appropriate term is Yahweh war. Numbers 21:14, 1 Samuel 18:17, 25:28. That language is used. This was Yahweh war. The reality of divine wrath and divine judgment on sin is reflected in the narratives of Israel's conquest of Canaan, which was undertaken by divine initiative, carried out with divine presence, is a theme that runs through the entire Bible. It's a theme that both Old Testament and New Testament envision as ultimately climaxing in the eschatological day of the Lord. Prophets have a lot to say about them. When God will come and destroy his enemies and those who do not believe in him and walk in his ways. This perspective indicates that the conquest of Canaan should not be viewed as an example of arrested evolution in the ethical sphere, but rather as an example of anticipated eschatology. Those two words, arrested evolution in the ethical sphere and anticipated eschatology, are the words of Meredith Klein in that reference there. I'm not sure at the moment where he discusses it, but it's in the bibliography there. I think that kind of sums it up. You don't look at this Qur'an as something that ethically is on some kind of subpar level that through Scripture rises to a different level in the New Testament. What you look at in the book of Joshua with the Lord's destruction of these Canaanites, that's anticipated eschatology. That's the day of the Lord in a small form that's going to be realized in a much fuller and complete sense ultimately at the second coming of Christ. And, you know, the New Testament talks about that. Jesus talks about it. Book of Revelation clearly talks about it. New Testament is not void of these kinds of concepts. And I think that behind it all is the idea that God has so made the human race and the world occupied by human beings in a way that reflects a moral order in the universe. There is such thing as good and evil. And God will judge the evil. And evil and sin should be taken extremely seriously. Because ultimately, there's no escape from death. And Canaanites experience that. Ultimately, all those who oppose God will experience the same thing. Question?
Wouldn't it also be a sign of his grace? Because of the judge, like Canaanites, some of the other nations around, they have the opportunity to repent.
That's right. And certainly, I think in the present time, we're living in a time where God's people organize differently. You don't have this political thing that you did in the Old Testament context, but we are living in a heightened time of grace where God's judgment really in this period came on Christ himself. And now you have the long suffering of God and the grace of God reaching out to people to accept him. But ultimately, that final judgment awaits when he's coming. Now, I think you're right. The other side of that is not everyone experienced the judgment of the Canaanites. Other questions, comments? Or do we need to take a break?